Salam alaikum. Peace be upon you. And that's what we hope to have, and that's what the theme of Greg's book, One Man's Mission to Promote Peace. Now, when I talked on Monday, we talked about how the first school came about, and that was the first school. And that's what he was going to do. He was going to build that school for the people in Corfe, and then go back to San Francisco, go back to his nursing career. He had been accepted at Case Northwestern for medical school. He was thinking about doing that, and other villages started putting in requests for schools. And he decided, yes, I think I can do that. I know a little bit about fundraising now. I know that you have to let the people do it themselves. So he agreed with five other villages that he would build schools. And that's when a fatwa, a religious decree, was issued against him. And this fatwa, an imam, the head religious man in one village, said he must leave Pakistan at once. He was building schools for girls, and he was an infidel or a non-Muslim building them, and both were forbidden. Well, Greg didn't know what he should do. This was the fatwa, was a religious decree. So he went to Saeed Abbas Rizvi, who was the head Shia Ayatollah in Pakistan. Sunni, Shia, most of the Islamic world is Sunni. Pakistan is about 85% Sunni, about 15% Shia. There are a few Aga Khan, which is an offshoot of the Shia, and a few Christians. And I do have to tell you a little story about the Christians. Alcohol is forbidden by the Quran. But in Islamabad, there is a government liquor store. And if you are a Christian, and if a priest will write you a letter that you attend services, you can take it to the liquor store. Foreigners can too, but it really isn't a problem, at least that I saw in the country, and most people don't. Well, that's an aside. And another aside, the black turban means you're a direct descendant of Muhammad. And so if you have a black turban, they trace their ancestry back. A lot of Taliban are adopting that now, just wearing the black turban, but it doesn't have to anything. Back to the story. Greg went to Saeed Abbas Rizvi and asked what should he do about this fatwa that had been issued against him. And Saeed Abbas Rizvi, the head Shia Ayatollah in Pakistan, said he would write to the scholars and head Ayatollahs in Iran. Iran is mostly a Shia country. He would write to them for their advice. And it was at this point that many, many of my opinions of Islam changed. I knew some of the things, and we'll talk about some of the things. But Greg waited. In fact, he came back to the United States and had come back again to Pakistan. It was months before he found out an answer. And then he was invited to the inner part of the mosque in Skardu, which is kind of like the state capital of Baltistan, met with the head religious people there, and he was sure that they were going to tell him that from Iran they were told he'd have to leave the country. Instead, he was given a red velvet box, and he said the letter inside was beautifully written calligraphy is a very important thing in Islam. He said, beautifully written in the old Persian script and translated into English, it said something like this: Dear compassionate of the poor, we are agreed that the Holy Quran does not prohibit the education of girls. In fact, our Holy Prophet Muhammad says all should seek knowledge, including our daughters and sisters. Furthermore, there is nothing to preclude an infidel from building a school for our children. In fact, that is operating in the highest principles of Islam, to tend the poor and the sick. And then it ended with instructions: no cleric in Pakistan should interfere with his holy intentions. And may the blessings of Allah the Almighty be upon you. And they signed it. Now, I had ideas about the Ayatollahs in Iran, and Qom, where the head scholars are, is where the nuclear plant is. So it's been in the news a lot lately. When Greg sent me a copy of that letter, I cried. I thought it was such a beautiful letter. And I wonder, why aren't we knowing it here, but even more so, why aren't they knowing it there? You know the word shalom, meaning peace, and salam. And Islam comes from salam, and Muslim comes from Islam. So if they are following, they really should be people of peace. Well, I learned some other things after that. The first word in the revelation to Muhammad in the Quran, and Iqra means read. And the first two chapters of the revelation to Muhammad in the Quran, the first two chapters are about how everyone should seek knowledge. When I spoke to one elementary school, one of the little girls wrote me a letter and she said, I just can't figure out how they won't let girls go to school when their Bible tells them to do it. So, why do you suppose that's happening? The Taliban have closed or destroyed 2,000 schools, almost 2,000 schools in Afghanistan, and 650 in Pakistan. Why do you suppose that's happening?
Because you can't convince people to go extremist if they're educated.
Most of the Taliban aren't educated themselves. And very interesting, a lot of them grew up in Pakistan in refugee camps during the Russian times. When the Russians were there, a lot of them went to Pakistan refugee camps where there weren't any women at all. So here were these men and these boys growing up without mothers and sisters and aunts, because in the Russian times, many of the women stayed in the villages, but the men went. And after they had been there years and years and came back to Afghanistan, they had grown up without any women at all. So it was pretty easy for leaders to tell them, you know, women shouldn't do this. In fact, I would guess a lot of them were really afraid of women, these very different creatures. So, the Quran says should read, should seek knowledge, including women and girls. In the Hadith is the book of, it isn't the sacred book, like the Quran is, maybe it would be something similar, maybe for us, like the writings of St. Augustine or St. Francis. But the Hadith says that the ink of a scholar is holier than the blood of a martyr. And so scholarship is held very high. In the Middle Ages, probably the whole light of knowledge was in the Islamic world. And I'm sure some of you know, what are some of the things that came out of the Islamic world?
Algebra.
Zero. I think two very important things. The constellations, how the stars moved. Just
preservation of Western texts as well. I think they were lost in Europe and then were preserved in the Islamic world and then came back.
In the library in Alexandria, a lot of it. So those were some of the very, very important things I learned. Well, what does it mean to be building schools in Pakistan and Afghanistan? Well, after this, Greg could build schools that girls could go to. Aren't they the most precious children? In some of the villages, parents didn't allow girls to go to school.
At what age did they start to wear the headdress?
Usually 5, 6. And I mentioned that on Monday, but modesty in dress is required. But there is nothing to say that you have to wear a hijab or a dupatta. You'll see in Saudi Arabia, even the men wear them. And a lot of this came out of a desert culture. So in the desert, where the sun is shining all the time, you're probably much better off having your head covered. But there's nothing that says you have to wear a head cover. And there certainly is nothing to say that women have to be wearing a burqa. Or in Africa, on the coast, they call them bui buis or chador when you're completely covered. Some of you weren't here on Monday. I'll repeat. That started in Saudi Arabia with the very wealthy women, and they wore them so the common people couldn't gaze upon them mm-hmm. when they were out in public. Well, if the wealthy women were wearing them, the middle-class women started wearing them, and eventually it became a common practice, and many people think that that is a requirement. When I've got a big Lutheran audience, I say, you know, you really don't have to wear a Norwegian sweater on Christmas Eve. The Taliban have destroyed almost 2,000 schools or closed them in Afghanistan and 650 in Pakistan, as I said. But in Afghanistan, in 2000, when the Taliban were in control of the country, there were 800,000 students in school. Almost all of them were boys. Today there are close to 9 million, 2.5 million. Females. That is the largest increase in a school population in modern history. How many of you have heard about that before? Shouldn't we? You have. And as women are being educated and being able to read the Quran, they are finding out the Quran was one of the very first places that said, if a man should die, his widow should inherit. In that whole area, as it was with the Jewish culture, if a man would die, his brothers would inherit. And the brothers were supposed to either marry or take care of the widow. Well, the practice had gotten to be they took the property but didn't take care of the widow and the children, and if those women couldn't go back to their own family, they were destitute. As women have gotten more education, as they're finding out that they have this right, right now the courts in Afghanistan are just clogged with land claim cases. And women can go to a government court, or they can go to an Islamic court, a Sharia, and they are winning their cases. So many, many women now are able to have land when they're finding out this is a right that they have, not only through the government and their constitution, but also through their religion. A little story to tell you about that. Greg and his driver were going through a very desolate countryside in Afghanistan. And Greg said, I think there's some people over there. And they stopped and went to this place, and it was a widow who had, when her husband had died, the brothers took everything, and she was living in a cave with her 9 children. They stopped, and the hospitality in Afghanistan, Pakistan also, is really quite unbelievable. And they had stopped, so she wanted to make them tea, but she didn't have any. So she had her kids go get water and grass, and she made them grass tea. The story has a happy ending, because Greg was able to get some money from someone, and they built her a little stone house right beside the road, and then sort of like a microloan, she got flour, some oil, and tea, and sugar, and now she runs a little tea house for truckers that go by. And so she's able to support herself and her children now. In this country, we place so much emphasis on voting. And every time there's an election in a place like Afghanistan, much. But if you can't read and you own nothing, the vote doesn't mean that much. It's going to become much more important as, well, men too are empowered to do that. Well, I want to go to a little, some few other things I learned about Islam. There are 5 pillars of Islam. Do any of you know what any of them are? 5 things.
Making your pilgrimage to Mecca.
And I'm going to put that as 5. Because that's if you can afford to and if you are healthy enough to do it. So it is a requirement for anyone who's able to. But if you're not able to, it's not a requirement. Any of you know what any of the others are?
Alms for the poor.
And in the Hadith, it tells about the question, what if you have so little? Then the answer is, you are to do what you can. What if you have nothing? Then you go and comfort the poor. What if you aren't able to do that? Then you are to do nothing that will be against them.
Ramadan.
And
fasting.
Ramadan or Tan or Adhan. And that's fasting. Ramadan is going on right now, and it will be until the new moon comes. And I can't understand it, but it seems to be a time of violence. And 9/11 is going to hit that, and this is all over the Islamic world that they're going to burn those Qurans. Okay, 2 more.
Prayer.
Do you know how often?
5 times a day.
5 times a day. Definitely for the Shia, and maybe 3 for the Sunni. 5 is, but you should definitely 3. And oh, that's a good way to put it. And the statement is faith is one God. Allah. And Muhammad is his messenger. And those are the 5 pillars of the faith. Anything that you would see there that would make a person say, Islam is the devil? The Ramadan fasting is something that they really mostly adhere to during the day, but boy, do they feast after the sun goes down. In the Middle East, where this started, your days are more or less the same length. But if you can think of here in this month, starting in August, pretty long days. They're getting shorter now. Last year, when it was even earlier, they had long, long days. And I have to ask in Alaska, ask some of the Muslims what they do there. They do have some dietary laws which are very similar to the Jewish ones. They don't eat pork. Meat has to be done in a certain way. The animal faces Mecca, they slit their throat, bleed them. Halal. Muslims can buy at a Jewish butcher shop. Jews can buy at an Islamic butcher shop. So those rules are. But these are really the rules of faith. And the difference between Sunni and Shia, at the time Muhammad died, who would be his successor? They chose some of his followers, and some of the people said no, they had to be a descendant. And there were some fights over that. And Hussein, one of the descendants, was killed. And so that made the split. And as I said, Said Abbas Rizvi wrote to these scholars and the head Ayatollahs. So they do more or less have a head person. And I saw one, I read about one, they said the Shia are more like the Roman Catholics with the Pope or with the head people, and those people are direct descendants in this case, and the Sunnis are more like the Protestants. There really isn't any, what should I say?
Central organization.
There's about 1 billion Muslims in the world. Where are they?
Indonesia.
Oh, very, very good. You're well done. Indonesia is by far the largest Islamic country. And the Middle East is down there, rather a smaller amount. The next largest number are in India. There are more Muslims in India than Pakistan. It's a bigger country, a bigger population. And then, of course, there are in the Middle East also. So we look at this picture and maybe despair. I wanted to show you this picture. This is a girls' school. This man is a Taliban, was a Taliban. In Islam, if you go on jihad, and jihad can be positive, it can be going to university or going to secondary school or going to the city to work so you earn some money to buy a piece of land, a quest, it can be positive. It can be joining the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. If you do that without your mother's permission, it's very very disgraceful. Educated women aren't letting their sons join the Taliban. Now here, this man did have some education, and he was shamed into quitting the Taliban by his mother. She said he had to do something positive for his people. So he, with a correspondence thing, finished schooling through 10th grade, and then he took teacher training, and now he's teaching girls in a CAI school, as are six other. They have seven ex-Taliban teaching now. And Greg said, if you want to talk about brave people, these men are right at the top of the wanted list, because the other Taliban don't want them teaching. One of the things that we hear a lot about is the suicide bombers. Suicide is one thing that is prohibited in Islam. And in the Quran, it is prohibited. It's a mortal sin. Well, how do you get suicide bombers then?
They don't know the Quran.
They don't know the Quran. And most of them are either physically or mentally handicapped. Not all of them, but most of them are. And they will go to their parents who are uneducated, and yes, they pay them some, but I don't think they do it because of the monetary. They do it, they say, your son or your daughter, usually your son, will be a martyr for the cause, will go straight to heaven, and will be revered by all the people. And here are these poor parents who have a child who is handicapped. They don't know, you know, how they're going to care for them, and then someone says they can be this glorious person. That's one of the biggest ways they recruit. There are also some that are recruited out of the madrasas that are run mainly with money from the Wahhabi, which is a Sunni sect, and that's the one that Osama bin Laden is the head of. And but most of, a great many of them are either physically or mentally handicapped, and that's the way they get them to do that. If they were reading the Quran, and if their parents were educated, it wouldn't be happening. This is a woman's literacy center in Afghanistan. 7 years ago, CAI started having some women's literacy centers, and they built 17 of them up to last year. Last year, they turned it over to the women completely, and now there are 127. But what I wanted to tell you is the Afghan army is 80% illiterate. You know, we read in the paper how the recruitment is low, and that's 80% illiterate. This Women's Literacy Center, just last month, two soldiers walked 2 hours at night and asked if they could have literacy classes there. Wouldn't that be something? If the women in Afghanistan would start training the army how to read and write. And Greg thinks one of the missing pieces that the NATO forces aren't doing as they're training the army is that they're not having literacy classes. He said maybe that would be where they should start. Well, there are a few other problems. In an Islamic world with a school, and one of the greatest ones is a lot of the parents don't think girls should go to school. And from the reading in the Quran, they can help with that. But they also found in one village where they weren't sending the girls to school. And so one of these men who was a Taliban went into the village and talked to the elders. And well, they said that they needed them for work in the houses, and the Quran said, and they corrected that. No, the Quran didn't say girls couldn't go to school. And then this teacher said, do you know over in Hushay Village that the fathers are now getting 7 goats as bride price for the girls who have finished grade 5? You usually get 1 or 2. And I guess that's a rather monetary way of looking at it. But they did change their mind about the girls going to school. And I have a little to say next time when we talk about girls going to school. But I think what I have learned about Islam, it's a religion of peace. It's a religion that encourages, if they're following their sacred book, encourages education. Muhammad wasn't educated himself, but his wife was an educated businesswoman, and he loved her very much. And I think we have to look at the time that it was written to. It was in the desert, and there was just a lot of cheating going on, a lot of sexual misconduct, a lot of brutality. And these words were to make life better. But the other thing Muhammad said, even though he had these revelations, that all people should respect the people of the Kitab, the people of the book, the people who had Father Abraham in common. So Muslims are to respect Christians and Jews. And Greg has really found that. Everyone knows he's a Christian. And they talk about it. And he has been very surprised how much a lot of them know about Jesus and the life of Jesus. Jesus is a very important person. He's not a savior as he is to the Christians, but he's a very, very important prophet, and his teachings are known, and his teachings are to be followed. And as I said the other day, Mary, Jesus' mother, is mentioned more often in the Quran than in the Bible, and Miriam is a very common name throughout the Islamic world. So they should respect the people of the Kitab. These are the 5 pillars of Islam. Seeking knowledge in reading are important. And that's kind of what I have learned about Islam. And it's, I can respect that religion more. And I know we aren't going to win hearts and minds by burning the Quran. And you think, what power 50 people have. I hope they change their mind before Saturday. That's about all I have tonight. Do you have questions? I probably can't answer them.
Infidel, that's what Greg was still called after he got the letter.
And an infidel, they mean it more as a non-Islamic foreigner.
Okay.
They mean it more in that way.
I was wondering if there was a different cultural meaning than what
yeah, it's different. Yeah, it's different. They use that word in English. I know an imam in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and when he was talking to a group of us, and he said, when I am speaking English, I say God. When I am speaking Arabic, I say Allah. And when I'm singing Latin, I sing Deo. And he said, to me, it's the same. Different words in different usage. And just a brief story from Minneapolis. There is an Islamic cemetery. And the custodian of the apartment I lived in, when his brother died, they got the last plot in that cemetery. There is no one that they have been able to find that will sell them land in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area to have another cemetery. So they're concerned about that. And you know, I kind of think of Minneapolis as being a pretty tolerant place.
I'm curious, just in terms of your speaking in this country, how much resistance you get in certain, do you find a lot of people sort of resist what you're saying about Islam, or do they? This community is pretty.
Not a whole lot, because generally people who come know what I'm going to be talking about. I told the other night the story about I was invited to speak to a group of peace churches in Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and then they called me and uninvited me. They said there were some protests from some of the people in the peace church because they heard Greg was working with the armed forces. And I said, no, you've got it wrong. The armed forces are consulting with Greg on how to build relationships. And then the next day they called me and invited me back again. So that was probably the resistance. Greg has received hate mail. He's gotten several letters that said, you should die because you are helping Muslim girls to be educated. They had to do some things like getting an unlisted phone because his kids were getting calls with threats to him. He came into the U.S. one time with a Quran that had been given to him as a gift, and they asked him if he was Muslim, and Greg said, naively said, I'm a U.S. citizen, you can't ask me about my religion. And he ended up getting strip searched and the whole thing. He said, he's learned now, you just say no. But this is just another story, but one time he was flying on Pakistani Airlines, and an announcement came from the pilot, and people started moving around. He said, oh my goodness, it's a warning, we're going to crash. And he was thinking about what they needed to do, and people were getting down, and then he realized it was prayer time, and the pilot had announced which direction Mecca was.
Did the floods in Pakistan affect any of the schools?
One of the villages has been flooded, but that school was up high enough, and that was a school in the Punjab. There's just one school there they built. The rest of his are in the highlands or in Azad Kashmir, and the floods aren't in that area, but they really are devastating. I can tell you the story about the school in the one village in the Punjab. His driver, I got to know well when I was there, is from this village, and their school was falling down. The roof had caved in, and I told Suleiman I would help them with it, and Greg said, well, we're not building schools in that area, so I took $8,000 out of my retirement and gave it to them so that school could be repaired in his village. That was 12 years ago. They've been having school there ever since, but they haven't opened it officially yet. They're waiting for me to come and cut the ribbon. And I was going last year, and then Suleiman had a heart attack. He's doing better now. And then this year, I had thought about going in October, but with the floods and everything, it won't be possible. So that school just may go on operating forever without ever being officially opened. So that's about what I have, if you don't have more questions. Yeah.
Could you tell the story again about the two gentlemen on the swing set, or are you saving that for later?
Well, I will go back and I'll tell you that story. I'm going to have it later too, but when The family, Greg and his wife and the two children, went to Pakistan in 2007. And I'll tell both of the stories. Amira had asked, what do the kids have to play with? And he said, well, you know, soccer balls, cricket they like, they really don't have very much and they have to work pretty hard. So she thought it'd be neat to take jumping ropes. So she went to Gold's Gym and Walmart and Kmart, I don't know where all she went in Bozeman, and really got a lot, way more than they could take. They had to ship a bunch of them, but they took a suitcase full of jumping ropes. And as they were going to the different villages, they went to a refugee camp. These were people who had lost their homes. Some of them had lost their whole village in the earthquake. And Amir said, this is where I want to give the jumping ropes. And Greg said, you know, Amir, I don't think it's appropriate. These children have been so traumatized. They've lost their homes, their fields, their livestock, their livelihood. They've lost family members. They've lost friends. There were 18,000 school children killed in that earthquake. And he said, I just don't think this is the appropriate place. Well, Amira was almost 11, you know, that age, and she insisted. So she gave the kids jumping ropes. And they were learning how to jump rope, and she was teaching them tricks, and they started laughing. And some of the parents told Greg that was the first time they'd heard their children laugh since the earthquake. And once the children started laughing, the parents started having hope. And rather than thinking we're here in this camp the rest of our life, they started talking about maybe going home, maybe seeing what they could salvage, maybe moving to another place and building permanent homes. And when they went there, I was working at Yellowstone, and in our store they had some really good binoculars, and employees, there was one day we could get everything 50% off, so I bought Greg a pair of really good binoculars, and when he was there, he gave that refugee camp those binoculars because they were going to use it to look for water sources, so that made me very happy too. Well, anyway. Then she said, there's something really wrong with your schools. And Greg thought they were really pretty nice. No playground equipment. So they have started putting swings and slides in all the school playgrounds. And the kids have to work there. In the morning, they've all got chores. And now they're getting up at 4:30, 5 o'clock, doing their chores, having their cup of tea, chapati if they're lucky, and they run to school and play in the playgrounds. Well, in Afghanistan, the board that he works with, they're hoping maybe in 10 or 15 years they can start building schools right in the Punjab, right in Pashtun area, where most of the Taliban are recruited from, and the literacy rate is really low. Some people think Afghanistan may be about 15% literate. In Kabul it would be better. Anyway, 10 or 15 years. Well, last year in July, some elders and some Taliban from Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban in Afghanistan, from his village, came to Lalander School, one of the CAI schools, and they said they wanted to see the school. Well, this is what happened. They laid down their AK-47s and their Uzis, and they were swinging on the swings, and after about an hour, the headmaster said, well, don't you want to see the inside of the school? And they said, no, we've seen enough. We want a girls' school with playground equipment in our village. So I have said I have a new solution for peace in Afghanistan. Swings and slides in every compound. And I wrote this to, emailed some cousins of mine, and one of them replied, he says, you know, that's very interesting. I just read a research study out of England on serial killers. And one thing they all had in common, they never had fun as children. So, swings and slides. Is that the picture you wanted to see again? And just look at how much fun they're having. Other questions? Well, thanks for being here tonight. And tomorrow I want to talk some more about why we need to educate girls.
Oh.
Thank you.